I think people associate multiculturalism with a particular political attitude, but I think, in fact, everybody's some kind of multiculturalist these days, in the just the general sense that people think it's appropriate to try to include as many different kinds of people in whatever activity they're pursuing, whether in the workplace or in government or at universities. And I think people have different ideas about what's the appropriate way to do this, what the mechanisms are, what the numbers ought to be, but I think people in general think that inclusivity is very important.
Critic and literary scholar Louis Menand. He'll be back in just a moment to talk about multiculturalism in American society and education. This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Lately, the risks and rewards of multiculturalism in both American education and in our popular culture have become hotly contested. Viewed from one perspective, multiculturalism is a tool of political correctness, adopted in response to the sins of America's economic and cultural past. Seen from another standpoint, it's a form of social therapy and symbolism that's intellectually empty. But of course, those aren't the only ways of looking at multiculturalism. Listen now as one of this country's leading critics explores the presence of multiculturalism in American education and in our society at large. Louis Menand is a professor of English at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. His work includes a new book about academic freedom scheduled for publication by the University of Chicago Press. Last fall, he wrote a piece about multiculturalism that appeared in the New York Review of Books. Can you give me a sense, Luke, of where multiculturalism came from? Is it anything new? Is this simply another, an old idea wrapped up in new clothing?
Well, I think that in the history of American society, the issue of difference and diversity and different kinds of cultural backgrounds has arisen many different points. And you can find debates about this in the early part of the century, particularly when there was a lot of immigration. And you find debates about it in the history of the university, about who ought to attend. The rise of public universities is a response to multiculturalism and the existence of different groups of people and so forth. But I think the current widespread notion that issues about race and gender are extremely important in everything we do is a consequence of the civil rights movements of the 60s.
What about the fact that, you know, we take pride in our history books and in our national celebrations around the 4th of July or, you know, just whatever kind of ritualistic function we're going through? We like to sort of brag to ourselves about how wonderful America is, how it embraces peoples of different colors and ethnic backgrounds. And yet when we come to the hard issue of facing these questions in the workplace, in the universities, in our popular culture, we really have a lot of very scary fighting going on. That's a large contradiction, is it not?
Well, I think that this fighting comes from the following reason. I think that the great movement forward in the 60s in American society was the notion that everybody does deserve an equal chance in every area of life, and that your race or your gender in particular, or your sexual orientation, should not bar you from living where you want to live, should not deprive you of having your vote count as much as anyone else's vote, shouldn't keep you from being able to go to any school, university you want, or getting any job that you were qualified for. And that was what we could think of as an equity movement in civil rights. Multiculturalism is a response to a different set of conditions. Multiculturalism is a response to the notion that although, by and large, legal obstacles to equality have been removed, these cultural obstacles remain. So that, sure, women can now get jobs as professors, but they feel they're facing a lot of male attitudes in the workplace that prevent them from being in English departments, let's say, that prevent them from being promoted or taken seriously or given the courses they want to offer, and that they face a kind of deprecatory attitude towards the subjects they're interested in. This is not a legal or equity problem. This is a cultural problem. It has to do with the deepest roots of people's behavior, their assumptions, the way they get along with other people, their attitudes. And that's why it's very touchy when these issues are raised, because people feel that legally, I'm doing everything I'm obligated to do. I'm treating other people as equals in that general sense. But I'm entitled to have my own attitudes.
Well, where then does the argument come from that if multiculturalism is a cultural phenomenon, if it is fundamentally cultural in its concerns, it is political in its expressions? That is to say, the critics of multiculturalism say, wait a minute, this is nothing but another political, raw political movement. It disregards cultural questions. That sounds like the opposite of what you were just telling me.
Well, it does have political consequences, and in fact, and unfortunately, the political consequences have tended to be to try to roll back, in fact, some of the gains that were made in equity civil rights. For example, the notion of free speech was very important in the 60s because one of the ways in which people protested what they regarded as segregation, discrimination, unjust treatment was to be able to protest and to say what they wanted to say and to be given equal voice and so forth. Now, for example, many multiculturalists of a certain kind suggest that certain kinds of speech which are offensive to women, let's say, or to African Americans, should be sanctioned, should be disciplined. And the same thing's true about things like one man, one vote. That was very important in the 60s to give everybody equality. But now people argue that, well, women, for example, or African Americans are likely to be in a minority. Therefore, they're always going to be outvoted. And the principle of one man, one vote, which looks very equitable on paper, in practice results in discrimination against the minority group.
Well, it sounds to me like you were describing, at least if we take this logic to its conclusion, we're going to rewrite the Constitution here. We're not going to talk simply about cultural assumptions and ethnic backgrounds. We're really going to fundamentally change the rules of our political game, in which we say, well, if we have a minority person or group that has been historically discriminated against, we're, for the next, 20, 30, 50 years, we're going to give that person or that group a leg up. Now, that doesn't sound fair to me. Argue this with me, would you?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't argue that position. I think that, in essence, I think some people do argue that position, a version of that position. That is, society is still racist and sexist, and therefore some version of, we could call it, affirmative action rights ought to apply. I think that the taking legal steps towards remedying what are regarded as culturally discriminatory practices and behaviors is going to be self-defeating. And I think, in fact, most of the cases in which people have tried to do that, for example, speech codes on university campuses, have been turned down by courts. And they've not been very successful. But I think that's the kind of militant sort of multiculturalism that gets people up in arms.
Let's follow that up, Luke Manand. Talk to me about multiculturalism in our educational system. Here, you know, in American universities, we have what is regarded as the finest or one of the finest educational systems in the world. We have people who are paid in many instances princely sums to think, to analyze social questions and to get through issues like multiculturalism. Yet multiculturalism seems, if anywhere, to be as explosive in the academy as anywhere else. The professors are the ones who fight about this. Yeah. Explain this scenario to me.
Well, there are probably many different explanations one could offer, and no doubt it's a very large confluence of causes. But one thing to say is that of among the most segregated places, not because of discriminatory rules or anything, but just historically, in the United States has been the academy. The academy has been dominated by men, and it's been dominated by white men. The numbers are enormous. And it's only in the last 30 years or 25 years that women and non-white people have gotten jobs as professors and have also entered student bodies at distinguished universities. And this has created a completely different population. And it's not surprising that when these people showed up, they were a little bit skeptical that the standards, practices, books being read, ways of talking about things were not race and sex neutral. They naturally wanted to raise the issue of why aren't we talking about these books or why aren't we talking about it in this way? And the defense that they met, which is, I think is what caused the explosion in the academy, the defense they met was, but we don't ascribe any racial or sexual particularity to the way we have of doing things. This is just a neutral way of doing things. And that didn't strike everyone as plausible.
What about the argument, Luke Manand, that in our educational system, when we teach multiculturalism, that is to say, it's almost like it's something we've gone to a department store and purchased, and we bring it into the classroom. It's a kind of thing rather than an idea. When we teach it in our classrooms, the charge, the critics' charge, that it's more of a kind of therapeutic or medicinal device than it is educationally substantive. That is to say, we want kids to feel good about themselves rather than truly do the hard intellectual work of learning about ethnicity and their own backgrounds. Argue this one with me.
Yeah, that's a fair complaint. It's one been made even by people like Henry Louis Gates Jr. has made that argument, that it's just part of the general American culture of therapy, that the whole point is to build up your self-esteem, and multiculturalism is just a way of saying, so you're, this is your background, you know, like you're a French-American, like me, so you'll be mostly interested in things French, which isn't true for me and probably isn't true for people with different backgrounds. But there is this therapeutic idea behind it.
Well, let me stop you for a moment. What do we do? Do we put the burden of the problem at the doorstep of the teachers and we say, you're the ones who have to intellectually, substantively invigorate the minds of our students? Or do we simply let them talk the talk and walk the walk, and then they have a kind of multicultural pill and everybody's supposed to feel better about themselves?
Well, I was just going to say, beyond what I said a minute ago about the therapeutic aspect of it, that there was a therapeutic aspect to the great books that were traditionally taught. There was a notion that we're reading these books because it will make us realize the glory of our heritage and make us feel better about our traditions, and that it will somehow have a medicinal property. I think that that notion, too, I think was somewhat misguided. And there's a sense in which multiculturalism is just applying that kind of culture as nostrum notion to a whole bunch of new books. It seems less plausible to many people applied to those books than it did to the old great books, but mm-hmm. I'm not sure that the view of culture is that different.
Is it your sense, Luke Manand, that multiculturalism is a tempest in a teapot, that is to say, an issue mainly amongst the academics and the intellectuals, rather than the general population? What I'm thinking of, for example, is this. If we turn on the TV set, or if we go to the movies, the staple, the content of a lot of our popular culture is, if not racist, it certainly revolves around ethnic comedy or conflict. We have a lot of sexism. That is to say, the extreme critics would say that many of our TV shows, a lot of our movies, are composed of sexist premises, that kind of thing. What I'm leading you to is this. Does the general population out there really give a fig about all this argument over multiculturalism?
Well, I think I disagree with your premise. I mean, look at the big television extravaganzas of the last 3 or 4 years. There was the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearing, which was all about sexual harassment, and then Thomas's claim that he was being persecuted for his race. There's been the O.J. Simpson case, which is all about, or certainly talked all about, the ways in which husbands treat wives and the gender relations in America. There's also a racial issue there. The Rodney King case. The William Kennedy Smith case, the Bobbitts, all of these cases which have glued Americans to television and to the tabloid press and the mainstream press and has interested everybody, have been talked about in multicultural terms.
But is that because they are multicultural in their content, or is it simply because they are national spectacles? What I'm getting at is the sort of mainstream stuff that makes up our entertainment, not the Rodney King trial and not the O.J. Simpson trial. The Simpsons, the TV show, and Baywatch, and Playboy magazine, and things like that. Those things seem to me to be inherently very conflicted along the lines of gender sensitivity and political sensitivity, in contrast to these cases that you have mentioned.
Well, that's true. There's a lot of American culture that glories in rather traditional notions about those things. But I think it's also the case that shows like Roseanne or Married with Children, to take a couple situation comedies, you know, really do bring up these issues, of course, in a comic context, in the way that All in the Family did 20 years ago. Uh-huh. And it's not really a question of how they come out politically on the issues. It's more a question of them taking them seriously and people finding that the kinds of conflicts between men and women or between blacks and whites are a source of endless interest.
Mm-hmm. Luke Manan, we're talking about multiculturalism. You are a professor of English at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. You have written about multiculturalism in the New York Review of Books. Talk to me anecdotally, specifically, about what goes on in your classrooms. What happens when, for instance, you are presented with the opportunity to teach a piece of literature that may or may not be sexist or have sexist elements? Does that intimidate you? Are you fearful of going into class and being sort of called on the carpet by sensitive or hypersensitive students or parents or faculty colleagues? What about this?
No, certainly not.
How do you handle that?
Well, I think that on the whole, I think I speak for most professors in this, on the whole, if you have a work of literature that has some kind of content that has to do with sexual politics, you're going to have a more interesting class, because my experience is the fact is students want to talk about those issues, and works of literature or films or whatever else you might be teaching often provide an excellent context for that kind of conversation. In other words, as traditionally, the work of literature or the work of art is sufficiently detached from us that we can have a conversation which is abstract. We're not just arguing with one another about ad hominem and ad feminem, mm-hmm. but we're talking about something that we've all experienced or read in a way that can engage the issues, as most works of literature do, in a fairly complex way. I don't think that's a problem. I've not, in my own experience, felt intimidated about teaching something that I was afraid might give offense to students having, for any reason having to do with sex or with race, though I think I've certainly run into problems with students who were religious, who objected to material that most people would consider very mainstream, romantic poetry, for example, mm-hmm. Or metaphysical poetry. And in that case, I think you have to tell the student to try to get with it for the purposes of the academic exercise and not feel that this represents some kind of infringement of their own rights to
Let me give belief. You a concrete example. It's a case that has been hashed and rehashed endlessly, and yet it is still a sort of a compelling instance. When, let's say that hypothetically you're going to go in and you're going to teach The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, there are words and phrases and racial epithets, language that occurs that occur in that book that black people are going to find deeply offensive. How do you teach it? What do you say to the students in order to, well, number one, get yourself off the hook, and then my assumption is that you're presenting this as an artifact worthy of their consideration in American literary history. How are you going to make that twofold case?
Well, my view of Huckleberry Finn, since that's the example you bring up, is that it's a profoundly anti-racist book, and that the assumption that people have made about the book, that because the word nigger is used a lot in the book, that there's something offensive about it to black people, I think is absurd, and that most people who read the book carefully and talk about it realize that it's a portrayal of a particular culture at a mm-hmm. particular historical moment. But that Twain's purpose in writing the book, I think, is profoundly critical of the racism of the American South in the 19th century. And it doesn't present any difficulty, except that it does meet resistance on the part of students, black students and white students, mm-hmm. who don't buy that view. And I find myself in a position of trying to persuade them that, in spite of certain ways of reading the text, that the text really is politically correct. Uh-huh. So that doesn't create a problem for me.
Well, now, that answer, that's an admirable answer, Luke, but doesn't it presuppose a certain suppleness of mind on the part of the students, that is to say, a willingness to have some give and take and to discuss why a writer would use a term like that? What I'm thinking of, to push this argument a little bit further, I interviewed a couple of scholars recently, veterans of the Women's Studies movement, who have written a book called Professing Feminism. The subtitle is wonderful, Cautionary Tales from the Strange World of Women's Studies. And they argue that they have students, women mainly, who come into class, and simply because they have proclaimed themselves to be feminists, they will not tolerate a male writer in the readings of a given class. Now that, respond to this for me. How would you handle that?
Those are bad students.
Uh-huh. And what do you say to them without offending their political sensitivities?
I wouldn't worry about offending their political sensitivities. I mean, students have all kinds of reasons for not being interested in reading some of the material that you require of them. But you don't get anywhere as a teacher by worrying about offending those sensibilities. And sometimes the sensibilities can be attached to a large movement, like the women's movement or something, and make people feel empowered by being part of a great mass phenomenon. But I don't think that that gives them the purchase on the disposition of the course that they claim. So that, I don't think that creates a problem.
Now, you have said that universities, you've written, Luc Menand, that universities are, what's your phrase here, ham-handed in the handling of multiculturalism. Do you see a way out for universities and their institutional conduct to navigate this problem?
I do. I find it quite amazing. I think. Let me just try to give an idea of why I think this has happened. In 1963, universities were about 96% white, and they were about 60% male. And now they're only about 80% white, and they're about 45% male. So that means that in a generation, a whole new group of people have showed up on campuses. Campuses that were formerly all male, like most of the Ivy League schools, campuses that were formerly all white, Duke University being one of them, now have a different population. So this has created a great deal of anxiety on the part of university administrators not to make it seem as though their school is hostile to these new populations. Places like Princeton or Duke or Dartmouth, where the white male tradition is very dominant and very long, really wanted to go out of their way to make these new populations feel comfortable because they wanted to attract the best women and the best non-white students they could. This has caused, I think, a certain kangaroo court quality to exist on some of these campuses in which the slightest suggestion that someone has uttered an epithet that might be offensive. The famous example is the one at the University of Pennsylvania where a student called some women water buffalo because they were making a lot of noise, and because the women happened to be African-American, they thought this must be a racist epithet. This thing seemed to me to have been blown hugely out of proportion, but it was because the administration was so anxious not to give the impression that at Penn, if you went to Penn and were an African-American, that they would let people use terms of abuse in front of you. Now, the other problem, I think, on campuses has been that the adjudication of these issues when they come up, charges that people have used hate speech or have sexually harassed and so forth, has often been handed over to departments of affirmative action or women's studies centers or women's centers.
Rather than who?
Rather than some more impartial bureaucrat in the university.
In other words, they knew the answer going into this.
Let's put it this way. They have an interest in making sure that people who might be hostile to their program or feel silenced or intimidated.
Should the professors handle this kind of question?
I tend to think professors are not equipped to do anything but profess. So the idea of handing over to them some kind of judicial
don't role, give them real power.
Basically, not. Yeah, that's my conclusion. But I think that that I don't see why universities can't set up some kind of system which everyone will agree is impartial and disinterested for dealing with these problems. Because the other thing is, and many cases have proved this, once, if someone's convicted by one of these sort of partial tribunals, once they appeal to federal courts, they're almost always reinstated or exonerated, or the university's got to pay through the nose.
So we're talking about an atmosphere in which sensitivity is a good thing. It may go too far, but it is essentially a healthy phenomenon in the universities for these kinds of fights to go on.
I think sensitivity is a good thing, and I think that the issue is a real issue about how people treat people who are different from themselves, because I think these are new situations for many people. I also think, though, that, as I said at the beginning, the application of legal standards to this and the effort to create some kind of disciplinary codes or system of regulations in order to control people's behavior, particularly expression, is self-destructive. Mm-hmm. It's bad for the people it victimizes, but it's also bad for the people who pursue it.
Let me ask you a final question here, Luc Menand, and I realize it's a very big order, but I want you to reflect on this for me. The debate about multiculturalism, does it go really to the health of our political culture, or does it go to the health of our culture? That is to say, the way we really engage, whether we regard them as great books or lesser books, but all of that history and literature that's back there on our horizon, is it essentially healthy for us as a resource, and are you optimistic about the way we're using it, given this very volatile climate that we live in, as multiculturalism affects that heritage?
Well, I would like to see the issues about multiculturalism having to do with the relations among people who have now have to work together, study together, and so forth, be detached from the issues having to do with what books we ought to read, what courses we ought to study, and so forth. I think the idea that the subject matter of academic disciplines is somehow has a bearing on the issues of what's proper conduct between men and women who happen to be in the same law firm together is a bad idea. I don't think that the great books are going to teach us anything about this one way or the other, nor do I think replacing those books with other books is going to give us a more useful repository of texts to lean on. On the other hand, let me say that I think that the fact that there are all these disagreements, it basically reflects a good condition. It reflects a society that is becoming more equal and more integrated than it's ever been.
Louis Menand is a professor of English at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. His article about multiculturalism appeared last fall in the New York Review of Books. His new book, A Study of Academic Freedom, is scheduled for publication by the University of Chicago Press. Stay tuned for information about writing for an audio tape of this program. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was Louis Menand of the City University of New York. Audio tapes of this program are available for $10 postpaid. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 746. That's program number 746, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code again is 27709. We're also interested in your comments and suggestions. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at ecsvax.uncecs.edu. Next week on Soundings, novelist Bobby Ann Mason. She'll be here to talk about and read from her award-winning new book, Feather Crowns, a story about families and fame in America at the beginning of the 20th century. Until then, thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.